From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's interesting and accessible. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. Today, we bring you a rebroadcast episode of Cool Science Radio. Due to our ongoing construction here at KPCW to bring you new and improved studios, technology, and sound, it's taking us a little while to, shall we say, cut through the concrete. Please enjoy these previously aired interviews. We speak first with Gabriel Brownstein, the author of the new book, The Open Heart Club, the story about birth and death and cardiac surgery. Brownstein chronicles the history of open heart surgery. The book is both a tribute to modern day cardiology and the unconditional resilience of the human heart. We interviewed him in December upon release of his book and look forward to hearing that interview again. Then in April, we spoke with Dr. Mark Durham from the University of Utah School of Dentistry. Virtual reality and augmented reality in teaching and in dental practice will improve dental health across the globe as students are learning exacting procedures like root canals using virtual reality long before they ever dive into the mouth of a real person. Virtual reality and augmented reality are changing the way that we can learn and perform services. All that coming up this hour. This is Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
Our next guest, Gabriel Brownstein, he's the author of the new book, The Open Heart Club, The Story About Birth and Death and Cardiac Surgery. Born in 1966 with a rare congenital heart defect known as tetralogy of Fallot, for which he received life-saving surgery at age 5. Brownstein has written the story of his life on the edge of mortality and the history of the remarkable people who have made such a life possible. Gabriel Brownstein, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. We really enjoyed the book. Maybe you can start by defining congenital heart defects.
Sure. I guess the first thing I'd like to say is just this is not a story about trauma. It's a story about being lucky, being saved. I really feel lucky and saved. Congenital heart defects are the most common birth defect, and they are the number one cause of infant mortality among all birth defects. It's really quite common. There are about 2.5 million people in the United States today living with congenital heart disease. That is to say, their hearts were repaired when they were kids.
Yeah. And let's go back to you being lucky. Your surgery was in 1966. Dr. James Malm, who had so much to do with perfecting that surgery, maybe you can tell us a bit about him, but he had only started doing this several years before that. Other than that, there would not be a fix for your problem.
Well, it's an amazing story. He was an amazing guy. It was really fun to interview him. But he took over the program at Columbia University when he was a young man, and he had actually never performed open-heart surgery before. The thing a lot of people don't realize is that open-heart surgery started with kids. People think of open-heart surgery as something that happens to adults, but it started with kids. When I talked to Jim Malm, I said, what was your interest in children? He said, I didn't really have an interest in children. My interest was in the heart. You said that my defect was rare, but it's the most common complex heart defect. Basically, all the kids who had it were not doing well before Malm, and then after him, we were.
You were a blue baby.
I was a blue baby, yeah, exactly. In the early 60s, blue babies like me had a very difficult prognosis, but I was in the first generation of repaired kids. So what I've seen in my lifetime is incredible progress and a set of cures that have kept me alive. It's like I have surfed wave after wave of innovation, and I'm able to tell that story in my book.
And such a compelling book it is. So many, so many things that I just had no idea of. And, you know, like you say, the fact that it was pediatric heart surgery that sort of paved the way for all heart surgery. And and then going back to the tetralogy of Fallot or Fallot, first of all, you say that it's so common, and common enough, I knew Shaun White, our Olympian, three-time Olympian, snowboarding, you know, we know him well in Park City. I knew he had something with his heart. I didn't know it was this.
So he doesn't like to talk about it. And I think that's an interesting thing, that most people don't like to talk about it. And that was one of the things I really wanted to write about in my book was, you know, a lot of people who have this condition don't say it, don't want to talk about it. One of the things I wanted to do was say, you know, this is very common. I mean, there are as many people as there are in the city of Chicago. I mean, basically, 1 in 100 hearts is in some way malformed in a child. Yeah, it's an amazing story. So one of the interesting things is that it was all started with women cardiologists. The female cardiologist invented the study of pediatric cardiology because the male doctors would not treat these infants because these infants seemed sure to die. This is in, say, the first half of the century, the 1940s, 1950s. And these women cardiologists studying people like me, people like Shaun White, figured out how to develop cures for these children. And in those cures began heart surgery, which has changed the lives of so many people in the country.
Talk about this. I mean, there are several cases that you talk about in the beginning, the Blaylock shunt, and that was known as the Blue Baby operation. Let's start with that one, if you would.
Okay. Helen Tausig, who is the mother of pediatric cardiology, was a dyslexic and deaf and a woman. And so you can imagine that it was difficult for her, say, in the 1930s and 40s, to advance in the field of medicine. And she was put in a very strange position in a clinic for kids with heart disease, which at that time really meant kids who'd suffered rheumatic fever. And there she began to study people, to study these children. And she developed an idea for a surgery to increase blood flow through the kids' bodies. Nobody wanted to do this except a surgeon named Alfred Blaylock, who was a very adventurous surgeon. And Blaylock had an assistant, a man named Vivian Thomas, who was an African-American technician, who was a genius. And Thomas, who, you know, wasn't allowed to use the white entrance at Johns Hopkins University, wasn't allowed to use the water fountain, wasn't legally allowed to have lunch with his colleagues, developed all the basic instruments and basic techniques of pediatric chest surgery, heart surgery, in the 1940s. And this was a huge breakthrough. But the thing about this procedure was it wasn't a cure. It added years to the lives of kids like me, but we were still marginalized. Still, you know, it would have been impossible for a Shaun White to survive. That didn't happen until open heart surgery, which came later.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Gabriel Brownstein. He's the author of the new book, The Open Heart Club, the story about birth, death, and cardiac surgery. Gabriel, I tell you, it was fascinating to learn that the heart and lung machine was not invented until the late 1950s.
Right.
Prior to that invention, open heart surgery, and folks, you have to listen to this, open heart surgery was performed with two patients in surgery side by side.
Yes.
First one whose heart was being operated on, and the second one was probably that person's parent who was also in surgery because their blood, their oxygenated blood, was being filtered through the child. And I just have to say this one other thing. You also tell the story at the end of that about a surgery where surgeon Dr. C. Walt Lilly used the lung of a dog to oxygenate the patient's blood because the patient's parent wasn't able to show up at the last minute, so they got some dog's lung. I mean, that's absolutely crazy.
Well, it's a long and complicated story to get to that point. But yeah, so C. Walt Lillehei, who was a Minnesotan, World War II veteran, a cancer survivor, and an absolute wild man, was the inventor of so much that we take for granted today, the pacemakers and open heart surgery. And he was wildly inventive. So the heart-lung machine was just not working. It was just too complicated. And all kinds of people were trying all kinds of things. One of the greatest surgeons ever, a man named William Mustard, a doctor, said his technique was so fine, he could sew together two farts. Can I say that on the radio?
Sure.
He started using these organic heart-lung machines, monkey lungs. He would clean monkey lungs and use those to aerate and oxygenate the blood of the children. That did not work. The machine was too complicated, so Lillehei had this idea. So a child in the womb gets all its oxygen from the mother, right? Child's lungs don't work. And Lillehei thought, I mean, the fetus's lungs they're not functional. So Lillehei thought, well, what if I did that outside the lungs, outside the fetus? What if I put a child on one operating table and the parent on the other gurney and just did a transfusion? Now, he built the machine himself. He used a dairy pump and beer keg tubing to run the blood from one patient to the other on the operating table. And he was quite successful with this for a long time. It was a highly risky surgery for all kinds of reasons. The parent or donor, people volunteered to do this to help little kids survive, people who are not related, when a parent was not available. The case you talk about, the dog lung, is very ambiguous and sad in certain ways. The child did survive, but this was, I guess at the time it was seen as progress. It was an African American child, and they could not get a blood donor lung, and they did use a dog lung.
Right.
And Lillehei managed to make it work.
Yeah.
But yes, that's a true story and a disturbing one.
Well, your book is chock full of anecdotal stories of history of the giants that today's surgeons shoulders that they stand on, because so many people came before them. So fast forwarding to 2019, well, we're knocking on the door of 2020, we're almost there. With all of this technology, with all of these advances, you say in your book that many chronic heart disease patients that require lifelong monitoring and intervention, the best estimates are that 90% of adults born with moderate to severe heart defects do not get the specialized care that they need.
Yes.
So let's talk about that.
Well, it's a terribly complex subject, right? I mean, one thing here is simple healthcare policy and economics, right? If your parents need heart surgery, the government will pay for it, right? Through Medicare.
Right.
If your child needs heart surgery, the government will not pay for it. That's how our system works right now. And so, you know, every year in this country, thousands of kids are born with heart defects, and we have no plans for those kids, right? None at all. And they do survive at remarkable rates. The technology is amazing. The medicine is amazing. But the transition from pediatric care to adult care, very difficult. It's very difficult to convince an 18-year-old who's feeling good, who has a surgically repaired heart, that they should pay for annual visits to specialized cardiologists who may not live in their town. You know? Mm. So we have this massive gap. We have all these people who are feeling good but may not be healthy, not getting the care they need. You know, I met people who, you know, the thing about people like me is we don't know what healthy is because we've always been sick all our lives. And so, and heart disease can be very, very subtle. And people can be in heart failure and pretend they're fine. And so this is a real problem that we face as a country. And it's part of a larger problem of providing health care to people who need it, with people with pre-existing conditions. But, yeah, 90% of adults who've survived moderate to severe cardiac deformations of their hearts as children, 90% of them don't see the right doctor.
You know, there's a statistic that I'm interested in, Gabriel, and it has to do with the number of people who actually know they have congenital heart disease.
It
seems to me that very often you hear of someone passing away suddenly, and only after autopsy do they find that there was a congenital heart disease all along. What do you find there?
Well, you don't want to terrify everybody. I don't want to terrify your listeners and have them think, oh my God, maybe I have some kind of heart defect and I don't know it. But probably there are people listening to this. You know, so 1 in 100 people are born. That's according to the Adult Congenital Heart Association, says 1 in 100. The numbers are born with a heart defect. 1 in 3 need surgery in the first year of life. 1 in 4 have surgery as a child. So there are a lot of people who have, and you can live with a heart defect and be perfectly healthy. You know, you can. There's some really, you know, you can have a small heart in the between a small hole between the upper chambers of your heart and be perfectly healthy. But yes, people discover. You know, I recently met a woman who discovered in her 60s that she had a malformation called an Epstein's anomaly, and it was really scary, and she had to have heart surgery. I met people whose child had collapsed running his third or fourth marathon. So yes, there are a lot of people who have undiagnosed heart defects walking around.
Well, that raises another question for me about these DNA testing sites that many people are doing now. It seems to even be sort of a pop culture kind of environment in which someone would do Ancestry.com or 23andMe. Can those congenital heart defects be detected through a DNA search?
You know, so a very small percentage of heart defects. I mean, when you say 1 in 100 hearts comes out malformed, that sounds scary. But if you think that, how complex it is for a heart to form in the womb.
Yes.
I mean,
it's amazing that it ever comes out right.
That it comes out right 99% of the time is amazing. I mean, heart valves are like these tiny flaps of skin that have to learn how to separate at a particular moment in gestation. And if they don't, terrible things happen. And because the child doesn't really breathe in the womb, because the heart doesn't keep the child alive in the womb, you know, no matter what the heart defect is, the kid's going to be born. So it's real. But there are amazing things that they're doing now. In Boston, they're doing surgeries on children in the womb to correct defects before they happen.
Wow,
that's incredible, huh?
Yeah. It's kind of like an amniocentesis needle, and they can guide it through the mother's belly into the womb, into the child, into the heart, into the particular heart valve that hasn't separated, separate the heart valve, pull the needle out. The kid is born without having known anything happened. And if there were no intervention, the child would be born with what's called a single ventricle defect, which is to say their heart would be sort of half-formed. And a kid can survive these days with a single ventricle defect, but it's a rough road.
I just wanted to note that, you know, there's a lot of PTSD that is surrounded, that surrounds a child who spends half their life in a hospital.
Yeah.
And so that in vitro surgery is pretty amazing. They won't suffer.
Yeah. And you know, I talk to a lot of patients, and they're wonderful people and amazing stories of just resilience and interesting lives. But yes, the PTSD is a real thing. And when you talk about the 90% figure, people not wanting to go back to the hospital after they've had heart surgery all their lives, yeah. You know, people who have heart surgery as children and survived don't want to go back there, you know? And that's part of the reason so many don't.
And when you were 6 years old, you had your first procedure. Again, it was Dr. James Malm. Tell us about the other procedures that you have had over your life.
Right. Well, I mean, it's been a complicated life. I mean, most of the time, everything's fine. And then every so often, there are these alarm bells that go off. I had a second valve replacement in 1999 that was quite controversial because there just aren't, there's nobody 10 years older than me that has this procedure, that survived what I've survived. The numbers are tiny. So I'm not in the experimental phase, I'm in the next phase. And every procedure I have is something that gains data for the next generation behind me. You know, there are many more people behind me than there are ahead of me.
Right.
So nobody really knew how to take care of my heart through the 1990s. They knew it wasn't working well, but they didn't know what to do. And, you know, heart surgery is risky, and not having heart surgery is risky. So the risks had to be worked out through that. It was terribly frightening. And now, I don't know if you guys know about this, but now they don't do most of open heart surgeries, valve replacements through open heart surgery. So I keep on having to have my valve replaced, but now it's an in-and-out procedure. I go in the morning, they slide the valve up through my leg into my heart, they take it out. The next day, I'm home, walking around, feeling good. That's amazing.
Similar to the path of an ablation, they come up through the groin.
That's true. It's called a transcatheter valve replacement.
Okay.
They guide the valve up through the groin, through the abdominal aorta, into the heart. And it's just this beautiful device that has this sort of tiny, tiny honeycomb structure that opens out. And there's, in my case, a bovine jugular vein, a valve from a cow's jugular vein that just pops out and fixes there. And no stitching, no cutting. And then they pull the catheter out. It's exactly the model of a catheter.
Yeah.
And you know, spend a night in the hospital, the next day, you're pretty good. I also have a rhythm problem, so I have a tiny little machine in my chest that has a computer in it and the therapy device
This is a defibrillator.
My heart. A defibrillator, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. You currently teach at St. John's University in Queens. What do you teach?
I'm an English professor.
Okay.
I wrote a book of stories and a novel, and got a job teaching English. And then I guess there was a point in my life where I was not doing well. And I write every day, and I didn't know what to write about because I was all I was thinking about was my heart. So I began writing this book, and you know, I had really a few purposes in mind. One was, you know, to thank my doctors, to figure out how I was alive, and then as I went on with it, to sort of tell the story of congenital heart disease, because that 90% number, so many people are out there in denial, in fear, not knowing what's going to happen to their heart, not knowing if they'll be okay. And, you know, the gap between that fear and the current technology that can save so many lives, extend so many lives, make so many lives full is just, it's something that has to be leapt. It's a gap that has to be
right.
Jumped. People have to get their echocardiogram so they can get the help that I've gotten. So that became another mission for me in writing the book, you know, to tell my story and thereby to help other people know theirs. I've met so many people who've lived their lives almost ashamed to tell people about this.
Right.
So,
Gabriel, I had a question for you. A chronic heart disease that mm-hmm. you know, when you are born, is a different set of problems than people with adult onset yeah. heart disease. It comes on later. And you yeah. made a comment in your book that getting doctors to train to be adult congenital cardiologists, it's harder to be certified. It may not be as lucrative as far as opportunities and
right.
and those sorts of things. This is a little controversial, isn't it?
Well, I don't know if controversial is the right word. It's problematic. I mean, mm-hmm. so look, at every elementary school in the developed world, there's a kid who sees a cardiologist, right? On average. But if you go down the street to the nursing home, everybody there sees a cardiologist,
right?
To be old in this country is to see a cardiologist, right? Every person in the nursing home gets paid for by the government. The kid in elementary school is often getting paid for by a GoFundMe account, you know? So the money, the interest, the technology focuses on the older people.
Right.
And the conversation focuses. I mean, everybody I talk to about my heart thinks, oh, yeah, you know, you're 53, you have an arrhythmia, you know, it's common. You're in that set of old people who had acquired heart disease. But the real concern that I have is for the family of the plumber who's self-employed, who happens to be in that 1 in 300 group that their kid needs heart surgery in the first year of life.
Right.
You know, and then that kid needs care their whole life. It's not just to fix that initial thing. It's, you know, their whole life they need care and monitoring. And we're just, as a country, we're not good at that.
Gabriel, we are out of time. We want to thank you so much for joining us, Gabriel Brownstein, who has written The Open Heart Club. And we didn't talk about it, but The Open Heart Club is a group of people that were all that all had surgery by Dr. James Malm and successful, and you guys got together in the 70s. I guess that's how the club started. But The Open Heart Club, the story about birth and death and cardiac surgery, we want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.
So you say that one of the reasons that you came to the University of Utah was because the willingness and the desire of the university to innovate with technology was something that really appealed to you. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, the strength the University of Utah has is in their faculty and their people and our ability to add people together, almost like bits of a computer. You are able to have more megabits of information working when you link to other people. And the university coming from a group of people who pioneered to get to Salt Lake. They've had this spirit of working together and connecting together and being humble enough to work together. That spirit is pervasive in this area in Utah. And so with that, in our genetics, I guess, here in Utah, linking to some of the brightest minds in the technologies I'm building was a very frictionless effort.
Nice. So dentistry, you know, it is a very hands-on sort of activity, but it's interesting to hear about the intersection of dentistry and technology, which is something that you were always interested in. And what was the genesis of that interest in technology and innovation for you specifically with dentistry?
In dentistry, when I started getting started in dentistry, I was probably 2 years into dental school, and I thought, oh my gosh, I think I made the wrong choice. It felt like there was a lot of rules for me.
Yeah.
I grew up in a family. My father was an artist, and my mother was very free-spirited. And so I got 2 years in with a lot of debt already due to schooling and just felt like, oh my gosh, I've made the wrong choice. And then I met a researcher at the dental school who said, you know what, there's a lot more to dentistry than just what you're doing working in mouths. There's a lot of ideas you could open up. And his name was Aaron Weinberger. He was at the time working with beta defensins in the mouth. And if you think about HIV, he did a lot. HIV has a hard time surviving in the mouth due to beta defensins. So he was pioneering a lot of work. And he said, you've got to come think with me in my lab. I started doing some thinking alongside him and other thinkers and got really addicted to building technologies in dentistry. And did that for about 5 to 7 years. Worked on generating new ways of doing procedures. Entered the VA system, which is a little bit less innovative. It's very bureaucratic, but still in that space, we were able to have a revolution of innovation in systems. And in building in that kind of closed space, we were able to impress the University of Utah, who said, "Come think with us in the School of Dentistry," which was just maybe a semester underway. And so since then, we've had the opportunity to build tooth technology that, unlike other technology, it can sense molecules in your... It's designed to sense molecules in the body, see a reactive protein as that may be building up when you're having a heart attack. You may want to detect glucose if you're diabetic. And so this tooth, this implantable tooth, which is in both the blood and the mouth, can sense saliva. The ideal would be for it to sense blood too, and it can detect different molecules in the body that you want it to, and then can send information to space. So if your father-in-law is having a heart attack, doesn't know he's about to, while he's walking through the Uintas, it can send that message to space, send it back to your care provider and say, we've got to get somebody at this geo position on the planet to help them before the heart attack. So that was one of the early technologies we started building with Florian Schulzbacher and Tomas Petelins, and it caught a lot of attention. Meanwhile, we started building other technologies in artificial intelligence for detecting cavities, which is really nerdy, but super fun. Then we started getting a lot of press on the work we were doing with virtual reality. Hardly anything has got as much attention as what we've done in virtual reality. It's taken off. And then also augmented reality. So those are some of the early technologies we built in just the last 5 years, connecting to really smart people at the U.
So I was told that one of the most painful things that you could possibly go through is if you're a burn victim and you're having your bandages changed. And we had heard of a virtual reality application, totally immersive experience where the child in a burn unit who's having their bandages changed is, you know, they think they're on an iceberg in this ice water with these polar bears swimming around them. And they're able to do that without any medications at all. And it's really evolved from the game stature to really being some useful utilities and tools for people like you.
Yeah, at one of the researchers at the university, Greg Boulage, he's developed a similar virtual reality module where he's a pharmacist. He built it so we could reduce the amount of opioids being delivered to human beings. He's figured out a virtual reality module fused with certain music that will allow you to obtund pain, to decrease pain levels very significantly. Similar to what they're doing, they're creating a situation where the child in the iceberg scenario is feeling more cool, as if I'm understanding what you're
getting. Yes.
So he would be Greg Boulage's work is doing something therapeutic with virtual reality, and also the Gap Lab at the University of Utah for people who have diabetes. In the early stages, they may not take it as seriously because they're not towards the tail end where they're having their feet amputated. By having some of these situational empathy modules, we're able to introduce them in the Gap Lab to pre-diabetic situations that would become very bad situations 10, 20 years later that you wouldn't be able to empathize with unless you had it happen to you. So using virtual reality to help us induce feelings of empathy is very, very, a very likely place that virtual reality will be a standalone technology that will be valuable. Today we had a conference with a gentleman from India who's interested in intimate partner violence and rape and acid throwing and using virtual reality to help protect women from toxic masculinity and other problems that they face there. Also here with suicide and elements like that are quite socially disturbing, that we might be able to bring down the rates of some of those more terrible things that we hear about.
So providing an immersive experience for somebody in the dental chair who's always had anxiety and has always maybe they haven't even gone to a dentist for 5 years because they're afraid of going into that environment. Besides that type of thing, the procedures that you perform are so precise. Can virtual reality be used as a teaching tool to help young dentists learn some of these procedures?
Right. So the question being, can the virtual reality simulate with enough fidelity to be able to translate skills? So our early work over the last 3 years has shown that we're working both with the occipital lobe, with us thinking about how the eyes take in information that surgeons would need to be able to be very precise with, and then also hand skills, which go through the cerebellum, the pons, and those parts of the brain. The simulators that we've been working with, we've been really able to demonstrate, as well as other universities. UCLA did some work recently with orthopedic surgeons, which is worth looking at, where they showed, they didn't publish, but they did show data that their surgeons are doing better, faster when they go through virtual reality simulation training. Our work in specifically, let's say, dentistry, we created a haptic, which is basically input. Instead of coming in through the eyes, it comes in through the hands and you feel pressures. It's a simulated pressure system that as you have the virtual reality system on your eyes and you hold the haptic device in your hand, it makes you feel like you're cutting a patient's tooth preparatory for a crown. We had students test in book learning, PowerPoint learning, and video learning, and then compared it to learning in virtual reality. And those students who had the opportunity to learn in the simulation of virtual reality were able to be what we call clinically acceptable much more rapidly than those who learned in traditional forms of learning, which have been on the earth for, you know, thousands of years. We've been dealing with books for quite a long time. So being able to compete with something that's been around for a long time is quite compelling.
Lynn, don't you love technology?
Yes. This is incredible. So when you talk about the training with virtual reality for getting that accuracy with your hands, talking about less than a millimeter of accuracy or, margin of error, less than a millimeter in these. That is incredible what you're training the hands to do. As we know, hands, I can just shake a little bit and it can be more than a millimeter. So,
yeah, Lynn, you're exactly right. Our a traditional crown that we would teach a student today, the portion of the crown that fits the tooth is called the margin. And that margin has no margin of error, no pun intended. It's supposed to be closed by about 50 microns. And so we're dealing with a very, very small space. We generally teach our students to do cuts that are anywhere from 1 millimeter to half a millimeter. And so that specificity of your hand is really precise. I mean, it really is. So,
well, and the other thing is I'm thinking about, let's say getting a root canal with a student practicing on me, which I don't know how it typically goes when you're not using VR or augmented reality, but the willingness to have people be sort of pilot testing these young students in dental school, it's a little scary. I would really feel much better about them having practiced in the way that you have introduced and helped develop.
Yeah, I appreciate that. We do believe that we can get our students out of the school with more skills. And the reason is, surprisingly, sleep cycles. The brain, particularly the cerebellum, it processes memory at night. So as you're learning to ride a bike, you ride and you practice throughout the day. You don't get much better throughout that day. But you get back on the bike the next day and you're like, wow, now I'm suddenly able to do this. The cerebellum is processing at night and it's consolidating memories then. So our students don't get into the clinic. Most students don't get into the clinic until 2 years into their dental career, which means 2 years of lost sleep cycles. So if we're able to get them into the simulators with absolutely no risk to the patients, because they're all virtual patients, and have them start going through the motorics over and over in the virtual simulator, that induces more sleep cycles. They get more hand skills, so they can be precise down to those small margins. The concept you brought up about root canals, Lynn, is compelling. We did some work, and I want to share this because virtual reality won't be a way to solve all learning problems. We did some work in virtual reality for root canals, and we found that unless we break the work up into work being educational work up into small little packets, if you have too many things for the students to learn, virtual reality doesn't actually advantage us. You have to break it down into, I would call them atomic, not molecular, atomic skills, where it's just one basic skill. So if the root canal is 5 to 15 steps, we'll teach them one with virtual reality over and over until they get it. Then they can do the next step. But if you do all the molecules of 15 steps all at once, our data shows that it doesn't work. So virtual reality won't be a silver bullet. You have to know when to pull the trigger when. So where we found it to be most useful in root canals is we can actually now see in 3D your tooth. Lynn, say you needed a root canal. We could see your actual tooth in 3D and imagine all the chambers of the tooth. In fact, we've gotten so good at it now that when we teach students, we allow them to actually walk through the tooth about the size of a convenience store. So we'll take your actual natural tooth, blow it up 300 times, and let the students traverse through it and allow that part of the brain, which has evolved for millennia, where we're really good with spatial awareness, and then they actually execute the root canal. It's a completely different type of imaging when you're walking through the patient's tooth before you do the root canal. Who else is doing that? We're grateful we have the opportunity to do it at the University of Utah.
Well, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
So most people have basic medical insurance, and most of those people don't have dental insurance, and these dental procedures are expensive. So when you were talking about crowns a couple of minutes ago, when will we get to the point where we're so precise in the making of our initial crown, that we won't have to send the thing out to be reproduced, and we'll be able to save some money, and we won't have to come back to the dentist a second time?
Right. We're seeing a broader adoption across the country in digital dentistry. Most curriculum today for dental schools require students to understand how to intraorally scan, where they'll take a three-dimensional scan of the mouth and they'll create an STL file, which can then be printed or milled. And so most universities today are teaching that. The cost is becoming less and less expensive for that type of service. But it's still there's still some complexities, and surprisingly, it's not the technology; it's the social that you have to train your personnel how to use that technology in the office. And since the dentist needs to be cutting teeth and not printing or milling, it becomes still a little bit difficult. So it's still more cost effective for us to send those digital files, those STL files, to laboratories who are set up to do that large amount of work. But we are seeing a broader adoption of that intraoral scanning and milling inside of offices all over the United States and also the globe, and we'll see it continue to decrease. We've seen the advent of printing make a small dent, but really the milling has made the biggest impact. We've been doing CAD/CAM for quite a long time in dentistry, but since 2008, when we saw the economy change us, the dental profession, from gold and metals, which became far more cost prohibitive around the recession, we moved more to ceramics, which lend themselves really well to CAD/CAM technologies, where you can mill those out quite easily, sinter them in a furnace, and put them in a patient's mouth in your office. So since 2008, we've seen a massive upswing of that technology.
Dr. Durham, early onset Alzheimer's, and Alzheimer's is a debilitating disease for people and for their families and loved ones. And fortunately, there's been tremendous inroads made in trying to understand Alzheimer's better. And I read this morning that researchers have also linked periodontal disease with an increased B
buildup in the neurological hallmarks that make up Alzheimer's. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and so my specialty is prosthodontics, so I'm more of a specialist in building and replacing teeth. The periodontist, my colleagues would be able to speak more intelligently about that. But we are seeing some of the most compelling...
What's this connection?
Right. We're seeing this mouth-body connection, which is very, very important, where in the past we may not have paid as much attention to it. But there's been research done by insurance groups who have found that if people just go and get their teeth cleaned regularly, that they're less likely to have heart attack. They're less likely to have a host of other problems. There's a massive amount of links to the periodontium, which is very surprising. The gums harbor an enormous amount of bacteria, as you might expect. That bacteria can make its way into the body, and it can form aggregate plaques onto the heart valves and create just a host of problems. We can also see problems with people who have joint replacements. So there's some issues related to the mouth and the system as a whole, and one of those is the Alzheimer's. So we've seen early research in the last year or two where they're linking the mouth to Alzheimer's as well, and we'll learn more about that. In my early days, I was doing research studies on preterm birth. So we found that there were some links between the state of your mouth and preterm birth, which has unusual problems for babies being born early. So quite a few links to the system and the mouth.
Very interesting. So in the beginning, and sort of related to what you've talked about now, the connection between what's going on in the body and your mouth, were the detection of certain enzymes and molecules and even proteins present in the mouth that this prosthodontic tooth that you've talked about, so switching gears a little bit into that to talk about what this implant can pick up. It's kind of crazy, and it reminds me, John, remember when we talked to the gentleman from Provo about his smart toilet, which was the same sort of idea, but one's a mouth, one's a toilet, right?
Yeah.
But you know, again, picking up and being able to monitor and measure different things going on in the body from another use and application of technology. So talk about the prosthodontic.
Right. We're very interested in the capacity to take the teeth beyond their general assumed function of crushing food. So beyond grape, nuts, and bacon, the teeth also serve as one of the few places in the human body where an implantable device can be placed both outside the mouth, outside the body, which is in the mouth, and inside the body, which is in through the gums. If you think about that, putting an implant anywhere else in the body and have it somewhat stick out would infect, would encapsulate, would be inflamed, and you'd shortly have to take it out. But for whatever reason, even though the mouth is teeming with bacteria, we're able to successfully place dental implants partially in the mouth and partially in the body. So we call that transcutaneous, and we're one of the few places on the body that can do that. So being armed with that knowledge and being a specialist in dental implants, I became very hyper interested in taking advantage of that. When you think about a USB is partially in the computer and partially out.
Yeah.
So using that technology as a way to have a USB into the body became very compelling to us. So with precedent work by Florian Schulzbacher, who was interested in seeing if we could start sensing things for firefighters, if there was if there was not enough air in the space you're in, that it would be detected earlier than a firefighter's brain could detect it, would be a useful application. He was building those systems out with hydrogels. We connected at the university. Now, Florian is, he's no dummy, my goodness. He created the brain-computer interface, right? So if there's people on the planet using the brain-computer interface right now, they should be referencing Florian Schulzbacher as the inventor of it and his company, BlackRock Microsystems. With Florian, we started working with hydrogels to start detecting. The first thing we started detecting was glucose. Then we got some funding because opioids had been a big deal. We got funding for fentanyl. We're also able to do ionic strength and other things. We're doing this work on a benchtop. We've got a lot of roadblocks before we can get FDA approval and putting devices in the mouth that can detect things and also bring the systems down. We need funding to be able to provide that type of technology. But I think the simple solution we were thinking originally was for diabetes, or I would say more particularly chronic disease. More people die due to chronic disease than anything else on the planet. I mean, it's a massive human killer. So if we can detect those molecules earlier on, then great. And what better way to do it than a USB that has a way to take information out every single day? Why is that compelling? Well, when we take our blood samples once every 6 months, a lot of stuff has been lost over that 6 months. If you can do it every single day, every minute of the day, that's when you really start harnessing the power of that technology for us to be able to say, there's a small trend taking place that's leading to these issues of cancer or other things. We should probably take action earlier than later. So that's one of the novel capacities that this technology will empower.
And so where are you in the development of this implant?
Well, we've received tremendous support from a group called Imagine Perfect Care. Imagine Perfect Care is one of the most beautiful things that University of Utah has ever conceived. It was done at a time with Vivian Lee where she approved the idea of creating ideas. So to me, one of the most special things in science are ideas. They don't cost us anything. They cost a little bit to make them, but then they can scale all across the planet and they make us better. She decided that she would create an idea tank. And I imagine Perfect Care was funding for people who could come up with ideas that would make the world better. So Imagine Perfect Care funded us a number of times to start building this technology. With that funding and some other funding, we've been able to reduce it to a benchtop model where we've proven that the technology works. We're now at a state where we're building like the Invisalign or straightening trays that you'd use for your teeth. We've got the technology reduced down to something you can take in and out of the mouth and sense what's going on in the body. Ultimately, we'd like to be able to be into the implant where it's sensing the blood, but right now we're able to sense what's going on in the saliva.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. To hear both of these interviews rebroadcast today in their entirety, please go to kpcw.org under the Shows tab and Cool Science Radio. You've been listening to KPCW Park City.